And I want to welcome everybody who is listening and welcome everybody that's on the stage. Upper and lowercase Terrence, good morning. Gabe Lord, Texas Toast, AC, Bob Van Kirk, I see you guys out there. How is everybody doing? How was your evening yesterday? Everybody still on mute, getting all the gunk out of our eyes and just getting woken up?
Getting there, man. Getting there. Good morning, Coleman. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Gabe. Thank you for asking.
Awesome. I had a pretty good evening last night, you know, gearing up for the weekend. The moon is still beautiful outside. I've been researching the Cold War, and it's fascinating. So, yeah, there's, you know, the parallels are just amazing when you really dig into history and look into it. So, anyway, not going to get too far onto that. So, just watching the entertaining news that keeps rolling out of all the usual places and the cycles, and then the crazy reactions all over the Twitter sphere. So, it's Friday, feeling pretty good. Got up and ran this morning, still alive, still here, still looking for ways to be more free and to bring grief upon my enemies.
That's the way to tackle the day. I love hearing that. And in spirit of Trump buying burgers on Wednesday, I made homemade burgers last night. And I got to tell you, I think they're probably the best burgers I ever made. I think the key was we switched up the cheese. We used smoked Gouda goat cheese. And man, it was amazing. Amazing, amazing. While everyone's still getting in here and settling in, I just want to make sure we go over the purpose of why we're doing this show. And that's to make sure we define the values that our founding fathers, what they fought for, our rights to liberty and self-speech, you know, freedom of assembly, make sure that these are not infringed upon. We need to go into our communities and find our friends, our neighbors, and instruct them about the power of Bitcoin and how it'll allow them to control their own assets and their own privacy, and that we as a community do not support tyranny in any of its forms. And together, when we're working all together, we're going to get this country back to what our founders fought for. We are all Bitcoiners, we are all veterans, and together we're going to accomplish this and give freedom for all. And if you are a veteran just listening to this, please reach out to us. Our community is growing every single day. Send us a DM. It'll put you in the right direction to get you help or just answer any questions you guys have. And we do have a special guest that'll be joining with us today. I'm very excited to announce Joe Consorti agreed the very last minute to hop on here with us. So I want to give him a big thank you and shout out. I see him in the crowd. So as soon as he gets up here, we'll start jumping into it. So if you have any questions you want to ask Joe, start writing them down and we'll start firing it off. But in case people are unfamiliar with who Joe is, he is the head of growth for Theia. It is a Bitcoin hardware wallet. And he's the institutional lead at the Bitcoin layer with Nick Bhatia. He puts out a lot of good reports, really good short videos. So I definitely recommend, if you're not following him already, go out there and give him a follow. And I see Joe's up here. So good morning, Joe. How are you doing?
Good morning, Cole. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me. This is actually my first time in the Bitcoin veteran space, so really, really excited to be here and chat with some really good people and you know, up here on stage and in the audience. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome back anytime. I just don't think it's just you have to come by invite only. We always appreciate people that are smarter than us, which is almost everybody. We're a bunch of knuckle draggers up here, so we always like getting good insight on how things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I guess, you know, kind of just starting off from the macro side of things, obviously the Fed cut interest rates. The big worry, of course, when the Fed did cut interest rates was that if they cut by more than their smallest increment, which is 25 basis points, that would signal the Fed is really not confident about the direction of the economy. They think that, you know, they see data that indicates that the slowing of the labor market is accelerating. They need to aggressively cut in order to try to stem unemployment from spiking. That was the initial worry. But now over the last 2 days since the Fed has hiked, yesterday we saw a huge rally all across risk. Bitcoin rallied more than 5%. The S&P 500 rallied something like 1.7%. NASDAQ was up over 2%. So clearly the what was supposed to be an indication that the Fed was worried about the state of the economy actually ended up being perceived very well by markets, you know, the day after. We'll see what happens today in markets. I don't think it's going to be too exciting of a day. There's no economic data that's coming out. Next week should be more action-packed. We have some housing data that's coming out on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then we have the third revision for GDP for Q2, as well as jobless claims data on Thursday. And then we have some consumer sentiment, personal spending stuff toward the end of the week. So I think today is going to be pretty boring. But what I'm looking for over the next couple of weeks is I'm looking at initial jobless claims, because that is usually the first pulse of what the labor market is doing. Over the last 7 weeks, they have beat expectations, or rather, in economic terms, they've missed expectations. They've come in lower than what economists have been expecting, which means the labor market has been stronger than expected for the last 7 weeks. You generally don't get those kinds of... far more prints that are worse than expected when you're entering recession. And you usually get more prints that are better than expected when you're entering expansion, or your economy is at least not heading toward recession. And initial jobless claims coming in better than analyst estimates over the last 7 weeks suggests to me that maybe we are getting kind of this Goldilocks, you know, moderating growth, moderating inflation without, you know, the labor market being disrupted too terribly and unemployment rate kind of being capped. Maybe that is the path of least resistance. And so that's basically where my eye will be. The reason equities have been rallying so hard is because they kind of witness that, growth and inflation risk actually is back on the table, given the kind of economic data we've been getting and the fact that the Fed decided to cut by 50 basis points. The Fed thinks that it is behind on the slowing economic data, but the market isn't too phased by the economic data we've been receiving. And it actually thinks that the 50 basis point cut is going to be even extremely supportive for growth and even extremely supportive for price inflation. We had that huge bout of 9.1% price inflation. It was insane. Now 2-year inflation swaps are trading higher. So people are buying insurance for higher inflation over the next few years. So, Powell could have just reignited that with what he did. So that's kind of how markets are trading right now. If over the next few weeks data begins really showing, okay, there is this super material slowdown that the Fed was trying to get ahead of, like we start seeing initial jobless claims come in way over estimates, hugely over estimates, you start to see business surveys come in extremely low, very disappointing levels, then yeah, Powell was justified in cutting by 50, and it's probably going to scare the market if we get extremely disappointing data after data after data. But in terms of surprises in the economy, everything is surprising on the positive end, not on the negative end. That's basically where the market is right now. Over the next couple of weeks, 3 to 4 to maybe even 5 weeks, I'll be keeping a really close eye on all of the jobs reports that we're getting, all the data coming out of the labor market. If basically the slowdown is totally cooled off, or is in the process of cooling off, then basically that gives, you know, risk assets a free ride to rally all through Q4. I think Bitcoin hitting 100K over the next 2 quarters is really a no-brainer. But if data begins deteriorating really measurably, then I think that warrants even further aggressive cutting from the Fed. And I don't think asset prices will like it too much that the economy is kind of falling out beneath our feet. But right now it isn't, which is a contrarian thing to say, because I know that my thesis for a while was that the Fed was too late to the party. But seeing some of the headline data that's been coming out recently, I'm kind of changing my tune about all of that. But that remains to be seen. But the market believes that the Fed is not too late. The market actually believes that it may be cutting into a rebound in growth, which means that inflation risks over the next year might be back on the table. That's how the market is trading right now.
So I got a couple of questions for you, Joe. And the first one would be, where do you see inflation getting back up to then in the next quarter?
Yeah, I mean, right now inflation is at, headline is at 2.5%. We still have core services, which are really elevated. Let me pull it up, actually. I'll pull it up on my terminal. Core services has been the stickiest component, and it is really, it has a lot to do with consumer spending. And so if you, the only thing that's still keeping price inflation elevated at 2.5% is core services. So shelter, medical care, transportation services, education and communication services, recreation, water, sewer, trash, other household operations, other personal services. So that is what's keeping price inflation elevated. Now, if rates are coming down, that means further easing up in already loose financial conditions. People who have been kind of hesitant to take on new mortgages because of how high rates are, they may be more inclined, they will be more inclined definitely as rates ascend from their peak to a neutral rate of 3%, which is what's priced in right now, instead of 5%, which is where we are currently, 5.5%, which is where we were on Tuesday, 3% by next July, which means that you know, mortgage rates are going to come down as the Fed cuts rates, as U.S. Treasury rates fall, which means that you're going to start to see more would-be home buyers actually take the plunge and start purchasing homes, taking out mortgages. You're going to see home prices rise at the margin as these mortgage rates fall. And chances are, from a price perspective, you're going to see home prices rise. Unfortunately, we've had disinflation. We've had disinflation in core services. From a core services perspective, it's actually accelerated, or at least at the very least, remained sticky for basically the whole year. So I think, in terms of like upside targets, like the 2.5 to 3.5% range is probably the new normal. It used to be anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5. I think, given how early the Fed is cutting now, because you know the weakness it sees in the labor market, I think 2.5% to 3.5% is the new normal. Also, because our debt really isn't serviceable if you have price inflation that is much lower than that. You need to let the value of your debt decay in nominal terms. You seriously can't service all this debt in real terms. And so letting price inflation run a little bit hot to erode some of the United States government's nominal value of its debt, that's a good strategy. And so I think that 2.5% to 3.5% is the new normal. So that way real yields aren't too high. Keeping financial conditions loose, supporting consumer and business spending. And I think you probably see, 2.5 to 3.5% price inflation being the new normal.
So to spin off that then, how do we get out of this issue that we're in where we're spending $1 trillion every 100 days? It just doesn't seem like inflation is going to be high enough to inflate that number away.
Yeah, so you can do a few things. You can do three things, actually. You can raise taxes, which, as we know, isn't very politically viable. You know, for the Democrats, a lot of their platform revolves around raising taxes for certain cohorts of people. The right is about cutting taxes. So either way, you can either raise taxes. You can cut spending, which is kind of political suicide, because we know that we're addicted to spending. Everyone likes spending for their constituents. If politicians didn't spend for their constituents, they would be elected out of office in the next cycle. So you could raise taxes, or you can cut spending, or you could just issue more debt. And so we're spending like 100, I think the last month's, the print that we had last was something like $140 billion in just interest expense being paid annually, which annualized is like $1.8 trillion. I think by the end of the year 2024, our new annualized pace for the final month will be $1.9 trillion annually. So you could either raise taxes, you could cut spending, or you could just issue more debt. And we have chosen the third option. Basically, we're issuing more debt than ever before, particularly bills. And the effect that that has, because banks have to absorb those bills, is balance sheet expansion and an increase in liquidity, which means banks have a higher proclivity to lend. We've seen that liquidity is reflexive positively with asset prices. And so as all this debt gets issued in order to kind of not solve this problem at all, the only way we could solve this problem is being austere. Those first two options I mentioned, raising revenue and cutting expenses. But we're never going to do that because it'll plunge us into a multi-year recession and it will be political suicide. What we're instead doing is just issuing all this debt, which is positive for liquidity, which means that buy and hold asset prices for dear life, because there's always going to be a marginal buyer for U.S. treasuries. But at some stage, I believe increasingly so, people are going to realize the game that's being played. And the marginal buyer will have to be our very own Federal Reserve. And so instead of the world and the world's banks absorbing this debt, it will be our very own U.S. Treasury having to Federal Reserve having to absorb this debt, meaning the money to buy that debt gets printed out of thin air, which is even more positive for asset prices. That's kind of how we resolve it. We never resolve it. I don't think we never resolve it. The only solution is austerity, and austerity is never going to happen. So at the individual level, at the corporate level as well, the best thing you could do is buy and hold Bitcoin and store it securely, hold it close to your chest, in a manner that's as anonymous as you can get. So when the time comes that maybe they do try to fix a lot of this, maybe they implement some kind of civil asset forfeiture, they won't be able to take your Bitcoin from you. That's obviously like super, super right tail risk. I don't think civil asset forfeiture is coming anytime soon, but for individuals, for corporations, for families, no one's coming to save you. No one's going to fix this problem. It's just going to get worse. More debt's going to get issued. So the best thing that you can do is buy and hold hard assets really close to your vest. And we know the hardest asset of them all is Bitcoin.
It's funny that you mentioned that, that people are just going to start figuring out. Did you see the Forbes article come out with the BlackRock headline, where they're quiet, BlackRock's quietly preparing for a $35 trillion Federal Reserve dollar crisis?
I saw that. Yeah, I saw the Forbes headline. A little bit of a contradiction in the headline, but either way, it's a fascinating headline. And I've read BlackRock's report too. Bitcoin, a unique diversifier. It's extremely interesting. And on page 7. Looks like page 7. Yeah, page 7 of 9. They talk about exactly this. They talk about, Bitcoin over the report. They kind of discuss, Bitcoin doesn't really fit into the traditional risk on, risk off framework. It trades with a risk on asset. It trades with the risk asset bucket, but being totally neutral geopolitically, it isn't really supposed to. It isn't meant to. My thesis with Nick over at the Bitcoin layer has been for a very long time that eventually, this informational arbitrage is going to narrow and Bitcoin's going to start getting traded in the risk off bucket. So something you flee to because of, geopolitical risk and kind of fiat currency uncertainty and debt level uncertainty. And that's exactly what BlackRock said on page 7. They said the growing concerns in the U.S. and abroad over the state of U.S. federal deficits and debt has increased the appeal of potential alternative reserve assets as a potential hedge against possible future events affecting the dollar. This dynamic appears to also be taking hold in countries where debt accumulation has been significant. In our experience with clients to date, this explains a substantial portion of the recent broadening institutional interest in Bitcoin. So they're saying that institutional interest in Bitcoin, a huge portion of it comes down to worries surrounding debt, growing and accelerating debt accumulation, not just in the U.S., but in other countries, the U.S. deficit, and possible future events affecting the U.S. dollar, whatever that means. That was a really annoying paragraph to read because BlackRock, obviously being the world's largest asset manager, they really have to hedge their language carefully. So they use like potential and possible like 90 times in one sentence. But either way, the big takeaway is that BlackRock, world's largest asset manager, is concerned about it too. Or at the very least, they're seeing that their clients are concerned about it, right? And so that's how they're writing about Bitcoin. So that's very substantial. you know, you got to understand the impact of BlackRock writing something like this, having all of these clients under their wing, having, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in total AUM, writing a piece like this and saying, yeah, look, you know, we lend some credence to Bitcoin being a geopolitical hedge and a hedge against fiat uncertainty, you know, against US dollar uncertainty and against, you know, kind of as a hedge against expanding debt levels in the US and abroad. That should be kind of, that should be vindicating for a lot of us here in the space who have been saying the same thing for a very long time, but we've kind of been sneered at by the Andrew Ross Sorkins of the world who think that Bitcoin is just a pet rock. You look at Bitcoin for what it actually is, its monetary properties. Yeah, it is. It is completely neutral. It is. It does not have borders. It does not have a balance sheet. It is a commodity. It is a digital bearer asset you could take with you. So, you know, and it's absolutely scarce, programmatically absolutely scarce. That's never going to change for the rest of time. And so if you look at it for its properties alone, yeah, it is the best asset you want to hold in times of uncertainty, but it isn't traded that way. And that means that, you know, everybody in this space can take advantage of this informational arbitrage in huge events of geopolitical risk, in these big events that nobody expects, you know, in financial markets, where you should be purchasing this insurance, this debasement insurance. It should be skyrocketing in value. It's plummeting in value because the algorithms trade it just like the NASDAQ. So everybody in this space should have a huge smile on their face knowing that, you know, car accident insurance is, instead of being six times more, it's actually like usually 70% off when the most car accidents are happening. So that should make everybody happy. And I think that BlackRock outlining that this is a reason a lot of their clients are interested in Bitcoin should be a very positive indicator that we're moving in that direction of Bitcoin being traded less in the risk bucket and more of the risk off bucket.
Thank you for going over that, Joe. Terrence, uppercase, you have a question, sir?
Flag Terrence, that's you.
Hey, good to see you. So I put in the comment section two charts from this, from Fred, St. Louis Federal Reserve. And I think you're familiar with these, Joe. One is federal net outlays as a percentage of GDP, meaning the federal government brings in a lot less revenue than it's spending, right? Every year it's more cash is going out than coming in. And that number is growing exponentially, right, over time. But as a percentage of GDP, because the GDP, the U.S. economy is growing as well, we're only at about half of what it was in World War II. And after World War II, we never paid down the debt. We grew out our way out of it because maybe they did some of the things you talked about, raised taxes, cut spending, GDP increased. So that percentage kind of fell a lot down to like from 42% or whatever it is to 12%. Now it's up to 24% and growing. But when do you think we will finally match World War II numbers? If you had to guess, taking out an exogenous event like a COVID lockdown situation or World War III, when's the latest we hit World War II numbers, if you had to guess?
Yeah, I'm trying to find it. Where did you post the chart? Up in the Nest?
I'll put it in the Nest now, in the comment section, but I'll put it in the Nest. Yeah, I just put it in the Nest.
Okay, perfect. I should see it in a second. Beautiful. Excellent. So let me take a look at these. Oh, I see. In the comment section for the post. Okay. Federal net outlays is a percentage of gross domestic product.
And is that a dumb number to look at or dumb? But Morgan Housel really likes this number. It's why he's not very worried. He's not a Bitcoiner, but I find him very smart on non-Bitcoin things.
Yeah. No, I think this is a very good number to look at because instead of, in the same way that you want to normalize like the deficit for the size of the economy, like you wouldn't just look at the outright level of the deficit and then take it as reason to be worried. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Sorry, I just lost the tab that I was speaking on. I have like a million Twitter tabs open. In the same way that you normalize like the deficit for the size of your economy, you normalize your, you know, all of your outlays, your interest expense, everything else, what have you. So I like this chart much better than just the up and to the right line of annual interest payments or, you know, monthly interest payments or whatever. I like this a lot better because it takes the thesis of a lot of people in the space, which is that, like, you know, this debt doom loop is imminent, wherein the United States has no option but to, you know, this problem is accelerating. And for now, we continue to be the world's preferred collateral. So there's still entrenched demand for U.S. treasuries. The Fed isn't going to be the sole, you know, or marginal buyer, rather, of U.S. treasuries for a very long time. But, you know, if we don't get our act together, this problem is going to get worse and worse and worse. And so the fact that we're still at 22-23% is very encouraging. It means that, you know, even though these interest payments have never been higher, so too is our economic growth, our economic productivity, like what we're producing, never been higher as well, right? And so obviously interest payments, given that this is rising up and to the right, are growing as a proportion of our gross domestic product. We were able to recover from a lot of that 2020 spike to where we are now. So even though we are increasingly reliant on debt for our economic activity, it's not like an imminent threat. Like, this isn't rising year after year after year. Our economy is still being able to manage itself well, you know, even as rates, you know, we are paying these huge amount of interest payments at the federal level. So rather than giving this like a timeline of years where this becomes a huge issue and Bitcoin, you know, really becomes this risk-off asset that we all believe it can be, kind of as the ultimate hedge against what is going to happen in the long run, where buyers of U.S. treasuries begin to treat them less like pristine collateral and more like, you know, as issuance not just increases but accelerates as garbage. That event probably takes place a few decades, if not several decades, in the future, rather than it being something that's kind of like right around the corner. Because even though these interest payments are becoming a problem, our economy is still growing and muting some of that upside on the issue that interest rates pose. When we're talking about the just the outright level of spending in the economy, our deficit just widened out from 5.5% last month to 7% this month. And so our spending is 7% higher than what we were producing. And so we've been running perpetual kind of these structural deficits since 2002. That was the last time that we were running a budget surplus, I believe. And so it's really the norm to be spending more than we're making. What this chart really illustrates is that rates cannot stay high for very long. If rates stay high for a long time, then the debt service becomes too expensive and eventually our economic productivity isn't able to keep up. Because obviously rates being high means that the U.S. Treasury has to issue debt at a higher rate. But it also means that that same effect weighs on the economy, because businesses and consumers have to borrow at a higher rate too. And so you get higher net outlays and a worse GDP. What this chart really illustrates is that given that the economy, like I just mentioned with the deficit, is so reliant on structural deficits, right? Spending more than we're making, all of this debt being issued, and all this money being spent into the economy, then rates have to stay low. Else debt service becomes too expensive. And you see this chart that Terrence put in the comment section and up in the nest, the latest one up in the nest, else we begin reaching World War II levels. So really the way that this gets managed is by rates coming down and staying low. So that way the economy gets supported and you have your denominator expand while your numerator falls. And that's how we avoid going to World War II levels. If we have a neutral rate that is like 4.5%, even though that's historically low relative to where we were during 2020, that is still extremely high, 2020 and 2021, the early half of 2022. So I think a neutral rate for the Fed and U.S. Treasuries is probably closer to 2.5% to kind of manage this problem and make sure that interest payments as a percentage of our GDP don't move up to these World War II levels. I think that's how it gets managed, making sure rates stay very low, right? We've kind of been in this this 70-year long, or rather 50-year long to 60-year long period of a secular decline in interest rates in US dollar capital markets. And I think now we're in for a multi-decade period where we're forced to stay here. Otherwise we bankrupt ourselves at the national level.
Joe, I'd like to get your thoughts. I know you posted a video a couple of days ago. But MicroStrategy just acquired a little over $1 billion of senior convertible notes, and they're able to purchase 7,420 Bitcoin for about $458 million. The remainder, $550 million, they paid out their senior convertible bonds. You were talking in your video about the importance of having Bitcoin on these companies' balance sheet and using it for long-term growth for shareholder value. Do you mind going over that and kind of what that means and the implications?
Yeah, for sure. So MicroStrategy has been a prime example of this, ginning up interest in the retail market for their equity purely because they're holding Bitcoin. Obviously, they have this enterprise software offering. None of the interest that has come up over the last 4 years in MicroStrategy's equity, at least none of the, let's say 99% of the interest, 95, has come from their Bitcoin holdings, not because of their enterprise software offering. And so you see that demand from investors reflected in their initial offering. They offered $700 million in convertible notes on September 16th. On the 18th, they announced its price. So literally Monday, they announced $700 million being offered in these in this debt. And then on Wednesday, they were oversubscribed. Now they were offering $875 million in aggregate principal. And then today they announced that they completed their offering of $1.01 billion. And so they saw a 30%, this massive 40% increase, rather, if we're talking about the initial amount in the amount of debt that they were issuing. And so that indicates, like, obviously this huge investor demand for Bitcoin exposure. People want, Bitcoin derivatives. That's why there's participation in the futures market. That's why people purchase Bitcoin miners. They want these products that are adjacent to Bitcoin and are drawn up at a different rate, when Bitcoin's price does well and when it does poorly. And so public companies have become some of this Bitcoin beta, have begun offering some of this Bitcoin beta by having Bitcoin exposure, whether you are a public miner or, in the case of Sailor, a public company that has Bitcoin exposure. And so now a new financial metric has emerged to gauge the amount of Bitcoin that's being held per share of that company. And that's a way to indicate to investors that, look, this is a formalized financial metric in all of our reporting now, which means that we're going to work to increase this. We're going to work to improve this to maximize shareholder value. So really, given the demand from investors for these Bitcoin adjacent investment vehicles over the last 4 years, started by Sailor and accelerated most recently by companies like Metaplanet in Japan, and most recently Cathedra, who announced that they would be formalizing Bitcoin as their treasury reserve asset, and also maximizing Bitcoin per share in order to maximize long-term shareholder value. Now that we have this formal financial metric, it's a way that companies can attract investors by basically telling people, look, we're going to try to maximize the amount of Satoshis that we're holding per share. Even if it means doing something like MicroStrategy has done, diluting their shares. If it means that over time they're using those proceeds to purchase more Bitcoin and Bitcoin per share can increase, then it might not be negative for their stock price. It might be positive because that's what investors want. So investors want Bitcoin to be held by companies. Bitcoin per share is a way for these companies to show how much of it they're holding per per unit of stock that they have out there. And it's a great way to attract investors. It's a great way to attract news. Metaplanet is now publishing it live on their website. Every time they, you know, it's a live dashboard at 3350.jp is the URL. And so I think it's just going to continue growing in popularity. Those are the implications of it. It's going to draw more companies into, obviously companies are going to want to adopt a Bitcoin treasury strategy for what it can do for their balance sheet. You know, even just a 3% allocation. River did this report, even just a 3% allocation to Bitcoin on your balance sheet can help you outpace the rate of money supply inflation. So it's an extremely attractive option from that perspective, but also from the public markets perspective. If you have access to, you know, public capital markets, you're a publicly traded company, just having Bitcoin on your balance sheet is insane for your equity price. We've seen what it can do for MicroStrategy. We've also seen what it can do for Metaplanet. We've seen what it can do for Cathedra now that they are once again back and listed on the TSX Venture Exchange in Canada. So I think more companies are going to adopt the strategy. More companies are going to add Bitcoin per share, use Bitcoin per share as a formal financial metric in their reporting after they adopt the strategy. And it's going to be, you know, a measure that really, really does drive investors to purchase their stock. And it's going to kick off, you know, it's going to kick off this race, which is kind of already underway, between companies to compete for shareholder dollars by maximizing shareholder value by, you know, raising Bitcoin per share as much as they can. So bit of a ramble, but that's kind of my thoughts on everything as it has to do with that.
Thank you very much for going over that. AC, did you have a question, sir?
Yeah. Hey, Joe, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this morning. Since we've kind of pivoted over to MicroStrategy, I was curious what your thoughts were on the FASB change from indefinite lived intangible assets to fair value accounting. When you think they might implement that, whether it's Q4 2024, Q1 2025, and then, you know, listening to the Quant Bros talk about the potential for MicroStrategy being added to the S&P 500 at some point in the future, I'd love it if you could share some of your perspective on that as well. Thanks.
Absolutely. So I don't know too much, you know, when it comes to this accounting rule change, but I do know that. So I have to do more reading up on that and getting more educated on that. But I do know that MicroStrategy has been in talks to be included in the S&P 500. I believe it's large enough at this point to be included. I don't know what other rules it has to tick off in order to actually get included, but that would be huge, right? You know, this this company that has managed to, you know, more than 10x its market cap in 4 years, now being put on the S&P 500. It's kind of like it's a beacon being put out to all public companies who are kind of sitting idly by, really struggling with growth. These low growth companies who don't really have many options to gin up interest in their stock and really grow as a firm. Seeing what MicroStrategy has been able to do and then ultimately being included in the S&P 500, from a narrative perspective for other companies, it's huge. It shows these low growth companies who may have been limping along for several years or a decade plus that there is a way to not just reignite life back in the growth of your company, but also interest in your stock. And then by implementing a strategy wherein you're working to maximize shareholder value by adding Bitcoin per share to your financial metrics, it shows that, you know, you can now have this this feedback loop, you know, where by adding Bitcoin to your balance sheet, you have this huge amount of interest in your stock. All of a sudden, you know, you have the ability to issue more debt that becomes oversubscribed because people want access to it. They believe you are, you know, you have high quality debt. If you're a good business with cash flows and now you have Bitcoin on your balance sheet to accentuate your profitability and serve as a cushion, then you can just grow from there, right? You can issue debt, you can issue more shares, you can do stock splits and grow and grow and grow and kind of implement this MicroStrategy strategy all the way to the S&P 500. So I think MicroStrategy's S&P 500 will be a huge beacon now to other companies who have been on the fence about doing the same, that you can go from being a low growth company with really no prospects of growth that's been limping along to a company that can reinvigorate life into its own growth, into its equity price, and in its company culture. And then all of a sudden, you know, years down the line, you too can be included in the largest mainstay U.S. stock index, right? So I don't know too much about the accounting change. I certainly try to take, with everything, I try to take a 30,000-foot view approach. So so I'm kind of the most multifaceted analyst that I can be, but that also means that things like the FASB accounting change, I really haven't gone deep into or specialized in that. So now that you mention it, I'll do more reading so I could have a better answer for you next time.
Awesome, Joe. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Really quick, I'd like to just give a quick thank you to our partners, Paladine Tower Tactics. Check them out at paladinetowertactics.com. Punchplate, I see you guys on the audience. Good morning. Check them out at punchplate.com. Black Sheep Ammo, check them out at blacksheepammo.com. And Solo Satoshi, give them a check at solosatoshi.com. So Joe, I don't know how long we'll be able to keep you or when you have to go. So I'd like to kind of get into what you think could be some setbacks for the price of Bitcoin going to Q4. What are some things you're looking for that could kind of slow down this next leg of the bull run?
Joe didn't like that question, Coleman.
He didn't. No, he had to take off, I guess. Now, Joe, if you're still out there, just hop back on. I think it's very interesting, though, just the oversubscription to MicroStrategy. A 40% increase since Monday. That number is just staggering. And I wonder how much of that money, I guess, where is all this money coming from? Like, are we pulling from the bond market? Like, that would be my question.
Hey, what's up, guys? Sorry about that. I got booted off there. Terrence, you were about to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, I know what happened, and this is more of a comment for the panel than a question for Joe, but, you know, as Trump is learning more about Bitcoin and going on his journey, he's starting to follow some Bitcoiners. And I don't just mean follow them on X. He literally follows them home. And Joe happens to be one of those people. He literally will go into Joe's house, and he has this weird, annoying habit. He'll grab Joe's mic and just start talking on a Twitter space. And so I think that's why Joe got booted off. I think Trump grabbed the phone and he did something, pressed the wrong button, but I don't know if he's there. Joe, but if he is, feel free to let him speak.
Hey everyone, how are you doing? How's it going, Bitcoin veterans? Veterans who like Bitcoin. You like your Bitcoin, you like your crypto.
How was the burger, Trump? Did you like your Bitcoin burger?
The burger was great. I loved it. I loved all the signs of Pepe the Frog. We like Pepe the Frog, don't we, folks? Pepe the Frog. He's a fun guy. There were signs of him all over the bar, pictures of me with Pepe.
All right, we'll give Joe back. Joe's got to go soon, but thank you, President Trump.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, no, he's strange. I didn't want to tell anybody that was the reason that I got booted off stage, but that's the reason I got booted off stage. Yeah, he does have that weird habit, but we're good friends now. So, to your question, Coleman, about why MicroStrategy stock price is doing so well. So this convertible note offering, for one, it was oversubscribed. So that clearly shows that like there's this huge interest to have exposure to MicroStrategy's debt. So that's why it's its stock price did so well. People want to buy its brand new bonds. People buy its stock, right? It's this huge kind of buy the news event. Also, I think like over Q4 is looking really great for risk just because of the stuff that I mentioned, kind of the slowing growth, if not growth rebound, and not like outright deterioration in the labor market and contraction in the economy. Like people are using the word soft landing. My pinned tweet for the longest time was that headlines about soft landings disappear immediately. As soon as the Fed begins cutting rates, my tweet got deleted because my account got hacked very briefly. It was compromised because I clicked the link from some scheduling platform. Anyway, soft landing, given the data, is looking increasingly likely. And this is all dependent on the labor market. But either way, really good stuff for risk moving into Q4. Also really good announcement by MicroStrategy. Clearly huge retail demand and institutional demand for this convertible note offering. So people are, you know, who can't get access to that convertible note, but also seeing that MicroStrategy is so strong and doing this capital raise, like they want exposure to that equity. So they bid up the stock, and that's why it's up so much. I think the question that you had before I dropped, before Donald took the microphone and clicked the wrong button, was about like risks for Bitcoin heading into Q4. For me, it just has to do with the economy. Like Bitcoin is obviously, it has its own native properties. It's, you know, it's immutable. It's decentralized. It's global. It's absolutely scarce. And these properties allow it to trade a certain way. And it also has these own native events within its own market that cause the price to go up and down. Obviously, regulatory perspective, for the longest time, the suppression of getting these ETFs in the market was kind of capping the upside on Bitcoin's price. And we saw what happened after these ETFs were approved. But also you've had regulators like Elizabeth Warren and basically everybody else who is working to cut off access, you know, the on-ramps between TradFi and Bitcoin, like Operation Choke Point 2.0 type stuff. Bitcoin has its own native reasons why it doesn't rise. Exchanges getting hacked, right? We saw the whole debacle with FTX and the huge fraud they were committing, Celsius. So it has its own native reasons why it doesn't go down. But I think now that a lot of that palate has been cleansed, rates are coming back down. It's gonna allow for a lot of breathing room for Bitcoin native companies. I think the biggest risk factors that are posed to Bitcoin just have to do with the macro side of things. It has to do with the labor market and whether or not the labor market is going to pick up in its pace of cooling from its current pretty slow and steady descent. I was of the belief for a very long time that the Fed was way too late to the party, but now claims data over the last several weeks has drawn me to rethink that conclusion. But my eyes are going to continue to be on labor data. So my eyes will be on labor data. I'll be taking a look at credit spreads, and I'll be taking a look at CDS for banks. Looking at default risk for banks is going to tell me the willingness that banks have, the default risk priced into banks, and it's going to tell me the willingness for banks to lend. Then looking at credit spreads, financing conditions for businesses, are they loose or are they tight? They're still extremely loose. In fact, they're at their loosest levels ever. Credit spreads oscillate between tight and loose and tight and loose. And for both risky and non-risky borrowers, they're extremely loose. If labor market data comes in worse than expected, if the initial jobless claims data that's coming out next week, which is expected to be an increase to 225,000 brand new jobless claims, if that comes in way above estimates, like 230, 235, 240, then you'll start to see a lot of second guessing in risk markets about the way they've currently reacted. The way they've currently reacted is the Fed is cutting in an aggressive manner. We don't see the weakness that the Fed's probably cutting in response to. We're going to rally hard. But if the market starts seeing the weakness that the Fed is cutting in response to, like over the next few weeks, really starts turning south, and then God forbid you see the unemployment rate ascend even higher from where it is now at an accelerated rate, that's when you start to see markets react negatively into Q4. You start to see credit spreads widen out. Borrowing conditions for businesses get worse, and that becomes reflexive. So that leads to even more layoffs, even higher unemployment, an even worse reaction in risk assets. So I think that's the biggest risk for Bitcoin going to Q4. If the economy can remain intact, which so far it is able to, and it will be increasingly able to as the Fed cuts rates, there is a lag with which monetary policy takes to take effect. It's about a year. And so many people think the Fed is too late to the party, but we'll have to wait and see. So these next 3 to 6 months are going to be critical. If the decline in economic activity can continue cooling off and kind of making this, rounding bottom before we ascend higher and economic activity, economic growth rather, accelerates again, then, it's all systems ahead for Bitcoin. The Fed has managed this cycle well. Dare I say, Jerome Powell will have engineered a soft landing at that point. But it's really just down to the next 3 to 6 months. If the data we're getting now, which is better than expected, can remain intact, which the path of least resistance is that it will be, right? Occam's razor is that it will be. The economic surprise index, which is basically an index that gauges whether or not economic data is worse than expected on net or better than expected on net. It is inflecting higher. It's been inflecting higher for a month. It's about to enter back into positive territory. So I think we're in for a quarter four of Goldilocks growth reports, which means you know, even further risk taking, and rate cuts get interpreted by the market as you know, just further financial easiness rather than a response to a recession on the horizon. And so for me, I think Bitcoin does really well into Q4 and Q1. I think we don't see a recession in 2024. You know, and this is, of course, all ceteris paribus, all else remaining equal, if things can stay the way that they are. But biggest risk factor is the labor market. And I will be keeping my eye on all of that data and updating everybody on it from my account over the next several months, so they can have their ear to the ground with all of it.
Where do you think Bitcoin's price climbs to in your prediction?
Yeah, so I'm always hesitant to give price targets. In the long run, I think Bitcoin is several hundred thousand dollars. I think by the time that I retire, Bitcoin is several million dollars. In the near term, it's really hard to predict price targets, but if data continues coming in better than expected, if growth is supported and we can avert a recession, and the Fed cuts rates all the way down to 3%, which is what's priced in now, then I think you see $100,000 Bitcoin rather easily over the next couple of months. And if we, if not Q, I think Q1 2025 is likely when you start to see when seeing six-figure Bitcoin will probably make the most sense. If the Fed ends up crashing the car and getting into catastrophe, and it turns out that it was too late to the party, which right now it doesn't look like it, but historically, particularly in recent years, they have been. Jerome Powell did a good job at managing in 2019 until a bioweapon was sent here, and that kind of upended the whole economy because everyone was forced to shut down. He managed last cycle pretty well until he couldn't anymore because it was out of his control. If he could manage his cycle just as well, this cycle just as well, then I think, yeah, Q1 2025, six-figure Bitcoin, is a high probability. I think it's an even higher probability that we reach higher targets sooner if the Fed does have to come in with some kind of emergency liquidity measure because it turns out they are too late to the party. If, you know, over the next several weeks, this good data we've been receiving takes a nosedive and it takes a turn for the worse, let's say claims data over the next couple of weeks, you know, next week it's supposed to come in, again, plus 225,000 initial jobless claims. If it comes in at like 240, 245, 250, you see alarm bells, you see Fed members come out and talk about, you know, basically trying to quell panic in markets. And then you start to see a more negative reaction to Fed speak in markets. You start to see the Fed cuts get interpreted as bearish. You start to see other data deteriorate. I think like if we hit a brick wall, and the Fed is forced to come in March 2023 style or March 2020 style or September 2007 style or September 2008 style with some kind of big emergency liquidity facility, then I think Bitcoin in the near term, just like it did in March 2020, stands to plummet, you know, 50, 60, 70%. But then we see what happens once that measure gets digested by the economy, which is Bitcoin rips and it rips even faster than it would have had that not happened, right? The 2020 to 2021 bull market. So I think either way, Bitcoin does extremely well. You know, it's just a function of when. And Bitcoin's ascent, the primary driver of the speed of Bitcoin's ascent will be whether or not we enter into recession and whether or not we get a liquidity response from policymakers in response to a potential recession. So that's basically it, right? TLDR is like, I think we see over the next 6 months, six-figure Bitcoin pretty easily if the economy can remain strong, if American excellence can abound and we continue being, you know, the world leader as we have been and the U.S. economy remains strong and robust. But I think if we do hit a brick wall, if we do enter some kind of recession, we all know, print, 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 Bitcoin loves all that. It soaks all of it up. So in that case, it gets there even faster.
Do you give any stock to the power law or the S2F model?
Yeah. We all know all models are wrong, but some are useful. I think I don't like using any model as a price predictor. but I think the power law illustrates a nascent asset monetizing into a larger one and graphing the X and Y axis. So price, so time and price exponentially is a good way of doing that. We know, you know, if you look at Bitcoin's price in log terms, it looks like it is kind of like a rounding. It looks like it's forming some kind of a plateau, like a kind of like a mound, not a mountain, but some kind of dirt mound. But then if you take the x-axis, if you take time and you graph that exponentially too, and you compress it, then all of a sudden Bitcoin's ascent looks linear. And so I think instead of the power law being a price predictor, which for many it is, I think it's a good model to use to see the direction of where Bitcoin is headed. And it can really be applied to any nascent asset that begins very small and gradually monetizes into a larger one. It's not just applicable for Bitcoin. It can be used for, you know, and I had Giovanni on my show, actually, on Theia back in March. We did two episodes. If you guys are interested, you can go back and watch those, and he explains everything. The power law is something that is naturally observable in nature. But for me, for Bitcoin, I use it less of a price predictor and more of a way to chart out the growth of a nascent asset monetizing into a much larger one. And it's a very helpful tool to see where Bitcoin could and likely will be 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now. But the important thing for everybody in this space is not to take these models as gospel and not to use them to trade. The only kind of trading you should do is dollars into Bitcoin over regular intervals. That's it, right? DCA, don't try to be a hero. Even the world's best wealth managers with all of the data in the world do not outpace index funds, which also means in a more volatile asset with far less data to go around, less tradable data to go around, nobody is going to beat just buying and holding spot Bitcoin, or better yet, DCAing Bitcoin and holding it over a long time horizon. There are probably like a handful of people in the world that are going to be able to do that. I'm not one of them. I don't think anybody in this space can do it either. The best thing you should do, the only trading you should do, is DCAing into Bitcoin at regular intervals. That's it. Use the power law just as a fun, unique, and insightful model to see where Bitcoin could be headed over the next several years.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And Joe, how much longer are we able to keep you?
I have a couple of things to write, but you can keep me as long as you want.
Does anyone else have any questions for Joe right now? I take that as a no. So I got one last one.
Actually,
go ahead,
Coleman, can I jump in one more time? Thanks. Hey, Joe, I put another post up in the nest, and it's circling back on MicroStrategy. I kind of threw this together, so apologies for how ugly it is. But it lays out the four requirements to be added to the S&P 500. I pulled a 10Q, one of the more recent 10Qs, highlighting the impairments of holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And then at the bottom, just the mandatory implementation date of FASB to fair value accounting. So, I know that you said you had to do a deep dive on, you know, what all of this really means. But maybe we could have you back at some point to have another conversation on, you know, what this looks like moving into next year. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, having positive earnings in the most recent quarter over the sum of the trailing four quarters. Okay, beautiful. So it begins taking effect after December 15th. Wonderful. So if that means if, you know, Bitcoin's price does have a very positive year, and MicroStrategy's Bitcoin holdings, are firmly in the green and they are firmly profitable, thanks to this, with this new accounting rule, this fair value accounting rule, you can see MicroStrategy in the S&P 500, you know, Q2, Q3, 2025, just taking a glance at this. But I'd love to do I'm going to do a deeper dive into this so I could have a better thesis around it. And then I'm happy to come back on the show and talk about it.
Awesome. I love it, Joe. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Joe, can we get your thoughts on the ETH decline against Bitcoin?
Inevitable and really fun to watch. It looks like an EKG for someone whose heart rate is, you know, they're nearing end of life and their heart rate is becoming less strong. The beats aren't getting any further apart, right? It's pretty consistent in terms of the heartbeats, but it's becoming harder for the machine to pick up. So it's falling and falling and falling, and it's going to keep falling. I think it's still, let me pull up my chart for ETH/BTC. Yeah, but at the Bitcoin layer, Nick and I have always called it the shitcoin electrocardiogram. So that's basically the way that we view it. Hold on, I pulled up the wrong chart. ETH/BTC. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, it's at 0.4 now. Whoop-de-doo. Like, we're having, obviously, big day for risk over the last 2 days. So ETH doing better than Bitcoin on a relative basis. But if you zoom out over the last couple of years, it is just an absolute doozy. I'll actually export this chart, post it, and post it into the nest so you guys can see what I'm talking about. But it really is an inevitability. ETH's last dying breath was the merge, and this whole idea that you know, now it's not just it's not inflationary anymore, and it's not disinflationary like Bitcoin. It's actually deflationary. But the problem is putting the rules of the network and the rules of your monetary policy in the hands of not miners who are not nodes, you know, but rather people who own the most ETH. It's inevitably going to make it such that people want to inflate this money supply, and so that's kind of what you've seen. This whole notion that, all right, we can maintain our monetary policy by expending zero energy. We've seen how well that did for Ethereum, and clearly it's not doing very well. So I just shared the post into the space. You can kind of see the chart that I'm talking about. But yeah, no, it's been down only since the merge to ETH 2.0, where they moved to proof of stake instead of proof of work. Everyone in this space knows that proof of work is this, it's this principle that extends far beyond Bitcoin's monetary policy. It's a principle that all of us live by and apply in our own lives, right? Whether it's with, you know, our physical health, our mental health, our work, our relationships, our religion, right? It's all proof of work. And that's the closest approximation to reality that you can possibly get. The moment that you throw some kind of Frankenstein, we can manage monetary policy with, you know, with having zero energy, you know, you've seen what is happening with Ethereum, and clearly the market isn't liking it. The market is voting with its dollars that Bitcoin is more valuable than Ethereum on a relative basis. This is the first bull market where Ethereum has not risen relative to BTC. The behavior you should be seeing is since 2022, middle of 2022, when Bitcoin bottomed, you should have seen ETH/BTC rise, because Ethereum being the smaller asset, it outperforms Bitcoin. But it is not rising. It has been falling for 2 years straight, from 0.08 all the way down to 0.04. And literally the floor is the limit for ETH/BTC. The market is voting that it doesn't view this thing as valuable. There are no narratives supporting ETH anymore. And when you're, you know, when the world computer, when this asset relies on narratives to survive, maybe it doesn't have very strong legs after all. Your asset, over a long enough time frame, it'll need to survive on its properties and its properties alone. Bitcoin has survived for 15 years now on its properties alone. It has not required any narratives. There are a million different narratives around why Bitcoin is valuable. But at the end of the day, its properties of being an absolutely scarce, digital, decentralized, global bearer asset allow people to hold it in good times and bad, because the money printers are always going. And the ability to hold this thing in your own hands, take custody of it, and see the value in something that's absolutely scarce, not just relatively scarce. That's why Bitcoin has succeeded. It is not needed narratives. Its narratives are its actual monetary properties. And ETH has none. At least ETH has none that a million other people can't have, right? Bitcoin, there will only ever be one Bitcoin, right? And so people are voting that it's more valuable than Ethereum. We've had this correlation shift where ETH is no longer rising relative to Bitcoin. I think it's a free ride to short this thing all the way down to $0.00. But not financial advice.
Oh, I like that. Did anybody else have any other questions for Joe?
Joe, you didn't like the song that Vitalik performed? Is that what I'm hearing?
It was really entertaining. He's trying so hard now. You know, I mean, I guess if you're a desperate CEO of the Ethereum Foundation, I would probably be singing too. I'd be trying everything. I'd put on a hat and I'd start dancing. I'd start juggling. I'd bring out an elephant. Anything to entertain people and distract people from my dying currency and try to gin up some last minute interest in it. So it was very entertaining. I loved it. It's like, it was like the, it reminded me of the band playing on the deck of the Titanic.
There's definitely some similarities there going down with the ship.
Yeah.
I know you stick to the numbers. Maybe one last question. Sorry, Colin. Any thoughts on how the markets could react to the presidential election, depending on which way it goes?
Yeah, so I think either way, you get a big old deficit, right? We're spending money into the real economy. Either way, you get a big old deficit. Trump is discussed. Obviously, Trump's platform is more accommodative to Bitcoin than Kamala's. But I think either way, the same debt dynamics we have here in the United States, those don't change. I think you get more fiscal spending under a Kamala presidency than you would with Trump. But really, we don't know because Trump is discussing a lot of things like big sweeping tax reforms, as well as replacing a great deal of our funding with tariffs. And really, I don't know how that could shake up the picture when it comes to how asset markets will react. So I think either way that the dynamics in the United States of huge amounts of spending and not bringing in enough money for it, those stay the same. But I do think Bitcoin does marginally better under a Trump presidency as a function of him being much more accommodative to the industry. But that's essentially what I have to say. I would prefer Trump to get in office, you know, for non-Bitcoin related reasons, but also for Bitcoin related reasons, right? He's clearly positioned himself as a candidate who is the most supportive to our industry. I think both presidents, the price trajectory of Bitcoin is the same. I think the ascent of Bitcoin is faster under a Trump presidency as a function of his willingness to work with the industry and make the United States, in his own words, the crypto capital of the world. We'll see if he fulfills those promises. Obviously, politicians say things and then don't deliver. But I think with both presidents, the direction of Bitcoin is guaranteed, the trajectory rather. But under Trump, you probably see more price appreciation and less capital flight for people holding Bitcoin and Bitcoin native companies.
Hey, Joe, going away from Bitcoin, can you talk about some of the studies or projections that these Wharton and Goldman people have done about how under Harris administration, because she is raising taxes on the rich and big companies, if that goes through, that her budget federal deficits under her might be lower, substantially lower than under Trump.
Yeah. Does that factor in capital flight of those billionaires from the country now that they have larger marginal
It also markets? Doesn't factor in. And if Trump does get elected, I really hope Elon does get to cut or suggest cuts to the federal government. I think he might do something like 99.99% if he could get his way. But politically, if I had to guess, just because he cut 80% of Twitter wasn't a problem. He had to hire back a little bit, right? So there's so much more waste in the public sector. But anyway, so I do think that that's not factored in if Trump is president, that the government could shrink. Potentially, or just not grow as fast.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, two things to consider, right? Do we want, billionaires to have a higher marginal tax rate? I think that, you know, they're better capital allocators than the government. And so for me, I would prefer if they were able to keep more of their money, and then allocate capital much better than the government can. I think when you're introducing a higher marginal tax rate for billionaires or for any group for that matter, you start to see, well, billionaires, because they are the most mobile, in terms of their ability to move their operations from one sovereign to another. I think that probably generates a great deal of capital flight from the United States elsewhere, past a certain point. So I don't exactly know the impacts that that'll have on the deficit relative to Trump's presidency, because, you know, in those particular projections, that kind of capital flight isn't factored in. And so, but also with the Trump presidency, like you said, bringing on Elon, Department of Government Efficiency, downsizing the government by a tremendous amount, I think you're cutting away a great deal of that fat, a great deal of that expense. And God knows we need to do that, because now interest expense is our highest, it's our largest outlay. It is our largest expense, which is insane. It's now higher than defense spending. So, yeah, it's getting bad. We need to save all the money we can get. But I think that the best thing we can do instead of saving money is growing money. And so I think getting out of the way of the best capital allocators and taking a lot of expense out of the government by downsizing it tremendously, I think that's the path of least resistance to get us back on track with the federal debt levels, but also economically. But we'll see how it all plays out.
Perfect. Did anyone else have any other questions? I'm going to take that as a no. So Joe, I want to be the first one to thank you for coming on here, especially sharing all your views and your thoughts. It really means a lot to us. And I also want to thank Trump for coming on as well. Joe or Trump, did you guys have any last comments you want to share with us or where we can find you?
Donald is sleeping. But yeah, you could find me at Joe Consortia on X. You know, if you found anything I said valuable or you want to keep up with my stuff, I cover Bitcoin and global macro, try to analyze it in as plain terms as I can, just so everybody can understand it. Because at the end of the day, all we need is information, right? We need information. And so I try to provide that information. So if you want to know what's going on, toss me a follow. And also check out Theia. I've been working with them since January. I'm now working as the head of growth. We are the world's simplest Bitcoin self-custody solution. It's really a delightful experience. If self-custody scares you, if you've been on the fence about bringing your Bitcoin into self-custody because of how hard it'll be, trust me, when you download the app and you set it up, it'll be so fast, you'll probably think you did something wrong. But let me assure you, you didn't. It really is extremely simple when you choose us. You get to choose how you want to hold your own keys, what kind of setup you want. And we have simple step-by-step guide in the app that takes you through the process. It feels like the most premium iPhone apps you've probably ever used. It is certainly among those. And you can download it and try it for free. So I'd suggest everybody to do that. You can check out Theia, spelled T-H-E-Y-A, on the App Store. Or just click the link in my bio to learn a little bit more. I've also got plenty of demo videos for you so you can see how exactly the app works. But I'd suggest everyone to download it, try it out, test it out. We want to get our Bitcoins off of exchanges, out of the hands of the Sam Bankman-Frieds of the world. So they don't, you know, go behind our backs, collateralize it, and then all of a sudden we don't have any Bitcoin any longer. So the only way you can do that is by taking your own keys. And the best way to do that is at Theia.
Oh, perfect. Well, thank you so much. And again, everyone check them out, give Joe a follow, and great content. So again, thank you so much for coming on. I want to thank everybody else who joined the panel, upper and lowercase Terrence, Bob Van Kirk, AC, Gabe, Punch Plate. I see you guys out there. Thank you so much. Make sure you join us again on Monday. We do this every weekday, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. Central Time. And then check out the Bitcoin Veteran Podcast. That'll be 7 o'clock Eastern Time. We'll throw the links on YouTube and on Twitter. Make sure we get on that mission. Again, it's simple. Tyranny or Bitcoin. It's really, really simple. I will see you all on Monday. Have a terrific weekend and get out there and go crush it.